Today on the 21st, police officers can seize property if they think it was used as part of a crime. We'll talk with the Cabrini Green legal aid attorney and State Senator Darn Harmon about why they believe that should change.
If I'm pulled over and there are Dorito crumbs on my back seat that the police officer thinks might be drug residue, it's not cause to confiscate the $80 in my front pocket and take my car away from me.
Plus, we'll talk with a researcher from the bipartisan think tank, the Century Foundation, about the role of socioeconomic diversity in improving K-12 schools.
It's encouraging that there are now 100 school districts, including places like Champaign and Chicago, which are trying to do something to address those inequalities and make sure that everyone can get a good education in a solid, diverse setting.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In Illinois, it's possible that an innocent person can have their personal property confiscated by law enforcement and then have to spend months navigating a complicated legal system to try to get their property back. That was the case for Cara Bland, a Chicago resident who spent 9 months and $1,000 to officially regain ownership of her car after it had been seized despite no wrongdoing on her part. There's a proposal right now to amend Illinois law regarding civil forfeiture that's in the works. And to help us learn more all about this, we're joined on the line from Chicago by Andrew Hemmer, an attorney with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Also on the line with us is Democratic State Senator Darn Harmon. He represents the 39th District, which includes parts of Cook and DuPage County in the West Chicago suburbs. Senator Harmon, Andrew, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me on, Ella.
Yeah, thank you. Andrew, you know, we first heard about this story because the Associated Press featured one of your clients. We just mentioned her, Cara Bland. What happened to her?
Well, without going into specifics about the details of her actual case, she, you know, is an innocent owner of this vehicle, and the vehicle was seized for a drug violation, and the person who was driving the car is her daughter's father. And so when he gets arrested and the car is impounded, Cara is the one that gets hauled into court to contest whether her vehicle should be forfeited to the state or whether she should get it back.
And so she didn't have a car for 9 months. How did she handle that?
So she didn't have a car for about 6 weeks. And the case itself took about 9 months to be resolved.
Okay.
But after 6 weeks, she got the car out on what's called a hardship bond, which allows a person to keep the car while the case is pending if they pay a 10% cash security to the court.
So, Senator Harmon, I know there are currently 12 states that require a criminal conviction to formally confiscate assets in most or all cases. And I know you're working right now on legislation to have Illinois adopt similar standards. Before we get on what you're working on, can you help us understand what the current Illinois law is about circumstances under which people can have their property confiscated?
Well, it's really a bit upside down, and it's much as Andrew described it. The police can confiscate your car or the money in your pocket if they believe it is used in a crime or the proceeds of a crime. There's no burden on the state to prove that case. The burden shifts to the person whose property was confiscated. It's worse in the cases like we described with Cara, where she wasn't even there. She loaned the car to a friend who then had a passenger who was arrested for possession of marijuana. That's really tangential to her ownership of the car. And yet, for 9 months, she's burdened with the process of trying to resolve the case. It's just fundamentally unfair.
It almost sounds like you're saying that it's almost, as you said, the inverse. Does the system then assume that you're guilty until you prove otherwise in the case of confiscation of property?
It essentially does, and it forces even an innocent owner to to go to court to navigate a complicated web of legal bureaucracies with which they are understandably unfamiliar. And we don't provide any public defenders or legal counsel to these folks. And they have to somehow battle with state's attorneys and police officers to prove that their car was innocent. It just doesn't make sense to do it that way.
Well, let me ask both of you, and Senator Harmon, let me start with you, and then Andrew, if you can weigh in as well. I imagine there are people who are listening to this who might be thinking, well, that's really unfortunate for Kara, but I do think that they're thinking, well, in the course of a case or the criminal justice system, or in order to have something proven, things like this might happen. And I wonder, I know the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police opposes the legislation that you're thinking about right now, Senator Harmon, but I wonder, before we get into the specifics of the legislation, what's your response to people saying, well, this, it has to be this way, otherwise we can't figure out sort of due process for or a criminal proceeding to how that would go?
I've certainly heard the argument, and I understand it, but at the very least, there has to be a sense of proportionality. It doesn't have to be the way it is today. If I'm pulled over driving a car, and in the trunk are 3 kilos of drugs and $300,000 wrapped in cellophane straight out of the movies, I think the case is pretty strong for law enforcement to move to forfeit the cash in the car. If I'm pulled over and there are Dorito crumbs on my back seat that the police officer thinks might be drug residue, it's not cause to confiscate the $80 in my front pocket and take my car away from me. There can be ways to reconstruct this process so that police still have a tool to use in legitimate cases, but they don't have free rein to police for profit, as the report suggested some might be doing. If we're going to have this tool, we need to make sure that the general public has faith that it's being used judiciously by people who understand the system.
Andrew, you work with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Do you have a sense that people out there have faith that this is being used judiciously?
My experience has been that the case of an innocent owner where the whatever offense happened is very remote to the owner of the car, and it's not a case where you look at it and say that, you know, the police should be able to do that and we should be able to take their car. And that kind of a case is certainly not rare. I mean, I would say that the exception is a case where there's 3 kilos in the trunk of a car and it's you know, a high-level drug trafficker that the police have arrested.
Is this mostly, does this mostly have to deal with drugs then? Are these mostly in drug cases?
Yes, it's almost, it's at least two-thirds of the cases in the Cook County courtroom are drug cases.
Okay. So, Senator Harmon,
also happens for people driving on suspended licenses, which it's just completely disproportionate to take away grandma's car because her grandson was pulled over and had a suspended license or an expired license.
Ah,
right?
I see. Okay. So those are the two major cases in which this is happening. Senator Harmon, what specific changes are you proposing right now?
Well, we're trying to make three major changes here. First, we want to make sure that there is transparency in this whole operation. People need to understand how it happens, when and where property is seized, the outcome of the forfeiture cases. We need to be able to track this so that we as a state can have faith that it's being used correctly. The second is the notion of a criminal conviction, or at the very least, what I find most offensive is that immediately the burden falls upon the innocent owner to prove that their property was not used in a crime. I think at the very minimum, the government needs to prove not only that the property being sought was used in a crime, but also that the owner had knowledge or was complicit in the commission of that crime somehow. And then third, there is a real perception that this forfeiture process is being used not to protect the public, but to enrich the police departments. And as we proposed it in the bill, the money generated from forfeitures could go back into social services that address crime in other ways, but doesn't become a piggy bank for the police officers, the police departments that initiated the confiscation.
I should mention we did reach out to the Illinois State Police for comment. We hadn't heard back from them by the time we had this conversation. Andrew, can I go through what Senator Herman said about these three things and start with the transparency? I'm thinking about Kara being quoted in the Associated Press story that inspired this conversation, which we will tweet out, by the way, so you can read that whole story to when SD shows our handle. Carr is quoted saying, quote, they intentionally try to make this process as difficult and confusing as they can so that people will eventually give up. What's the process right now? What you said it was 9 months for her to get her to kind of get all of this resolved. Is it a very complicated process?
It is an extremely complicated process. And I think what she's referencing there is not the state's attorneys or the courts or court personnel, but referencing that the statute makes it intentionally makes it hard for people to challenge these forfeitures, so that they'll eventually give up. The procedures that are in place now start with the owner needing to file a claim with the state's attorney's office and pay 10% of the property's value just to be able to challenge the forfeiture. And then after the claim is filed, it's about 3 months before you have your first official court date. And then from there, depending on what's going on with the criminal case, discovery issues, stuff like that, it could be anywhere from 60 days to multiple years before you actually have a trial and it's decided one way or the other whether your property is going to be forfeited. And I just want to emphasize that, again, I think what the point of her comment and what I believe is that the statute is really what makes it so unfair. And makes this process so onerous. It's not. I mean, our state's attorneys and our judges are extremely fair, but we have to work under these statutes, and we do the best we can under these under the unfair statutes that currently exist.
And Andrew, you're with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. I know you represented Kara for free after she couldn't no longer afford her initial lawyer. Do you imagine that a lot of people, or are there a lot of people in her situation who can't afford to go through the legal process of getting their property back, even if they are innocent, or maybe start the process and then just give up because it's too expensive?
Yes, there are.
How much would it cost? You represented her for free. What's the sense of how much it could cost someone to get their property back?
In terms of hiring an attorney?
Yeah, I mean, how many hours of attorney fees would there be?
I mean, I think probably in Chicago it would be somewhere between $2,000 to $5,000 that it would cost for an attorney to do one of these forfeiture cases, and in many cases the property is worth $5,000 or less.
So they're essentially paying the price of their property to get their property back.
Right, okay. and even the time cost of going through, possibly 1 to 3 years of legal proceedings and continuing to pay on a car note, possibly paying to use public transportation, et cetera, at a certain point, it's like you could just – many people could just put down a couple $1,000s on a down payment on a new car as opposed to going through these proceedings. But there are more – I'll tell you that there are more cases like that than you can imagine, even just in Cook County. I mean, we get calls every day from people that that meet our income guidelines and have a forfeiture situation going on, and most of the time they're an innocent owner and have a very similar situation to Kara's.
Senator Herman, you mentioned about forfeiture and that there's a perception that this somehow benefits police departments, the cost of this. I mentioned we did reach out to the ISP for comment on this. I know the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police opposes what you have proposed. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're proposing, and have you been working with the police department to sort of make this something that maybe you guys can agree on?
Absolutely, and I really do want to emphasize this. The advocates for the bill, along with our House sponsor, Representative Will Guzzardi, and I, have been negotiating in good faith with the state's attorneys, with the chiefs of police, with the Illinois State Police, and to their credit, they have been very good negotiating partners. They recognize that there are warts on this current system and that a few bad actors taint the entire process for even the departments that are doing this responsibly. And they know that something needs to change. They've also recognized, I think, that fundamental imbalance. A state's attorney lives in the courtroom. An innocent owner whose car has been tagged for forfeiture may never have been in a courtroom in her life. They recognize that we need to make this process more simple and understandable, and the courthouse more approachable for someone in this circumstance. And I think that they recognize that the burden fairly falls on them as the government seeking to take the property to prove that it should be taken.
So, Senator Herman,
I'm looking forward
yeah.
to reaching an agreement with them. I think that there's plenty of room in the middle for a good faith compromise.
And so, what are the next steps for you all? Where are we at with what you're proposing? You mentioned you're in the Senate. You mentioned Representative Guzzardi in the House. Where are you guys at?
We are still engaged in active negotiations. I hope that shortly after the spring recess, when we return to Springfield, we'll be filing an amendment that reflects all the progress that we've made. And I'm confident that in the end we're going to have a meaningful structural reform so that the statute itself is not so imposing and one-sided, and that in the end innocent owners will be spared from the real indignity that so many have suffered because of this, and police officers will retain what they believe is an important tool in fighting crimes, especially drug trafficking.
That's State Senator Don Herman, a Democrat representing Illinois' 39th district. That includes parts of Cook and DuPage County. I want to thank also from Chicago as well, Cabrini Green, legal aid attorney, Andrew Hemmer, who's also an Equal Justice Works fellow, for sharing with us a little bit about this. Andrew, Senator Herman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The conversation on how to improve our public schools has been ongoing for years, and there's lots of ways that presidents have tried to solve this, whether we think about the No Child Left Behind or now Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's advocacy for expanding charter schools and voucher programs. When we talk about improving schools, integration is often a term that comes up. When we use the word integration, we tend to think about race and ethnicity. But Richard Collenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, says he has a solution that focuses on social and economic diversity. The idea is that students from schools in areas with higher poverty actually do better when they have classmates that have more socioeconomic diversity. And that's a far more powerful thing than just providing more resources to those schools. The bipartisan think tank Century Foundation recently released a paper that used nine different case studies to further this argument. And two of those case studies were in Illinois, in Chicago and Champaign schools. Richard Collenberg is on the line with us now from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Julie Worth, a reporter at the News Gazette in Champaign, to discuss both of these school districts. Richard, Julie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Richard, let's start with you. First, what's the general idea behind why having middle class, and I don't know if you also include upper income students, mixing that student population with lower income students, how does that help improve the situation?
Well, there's research going back 50 years to suggest that one of the best things we can do for low income students is give them a chance to go to economically mixed schools as opposed to high poverty schools. So in these economically diverse, often racially diverse schools, students are surrounded by peers who have big dreams. Many of them expect to go on to college. They're also surrounded by a group of parents who are in a position to, you know, be active in school affairs, volunteer in class. They're not working three jobs the way a lot of low-income families are. And you tend to get the strongest teachers in economically mixed schools as opposed to high poverty schools. And so nationally, low-income students who are in middle-class schools are as much as 2 years ahead of low-income students stuck in high-poverty schools. And the last reason to be for this is that middle-class students and white students will also benefit from diversity and learning from the different perspectives that different life experiences help shape from students of all backgrounds.
Now, in this most recent paper that you all put out, you looked at 9 different case studies. Why did the Century Foundation decide to include Champaign and Chicago schools in this nationwide look at this?
Well, for different reasons. Champaign is one of the leading school districts for using choice rather than, you know, the old style of compulsory busing for integration. And they've done a really good job of marrying the idea of choice and school diversity. So I think about 90% of parents get one of their first choices among a variety of options. And so that's part of why we thought they were important to look at. In the case of Chicago, it has one of the most innovative socioeconomic integration programs and helps demonstrate that it's possible, even in a very large district, even one that has high levels of poverty, to try to begin to integrate at least a subset of schools. I should add that, you know, in neither of the cases is the system perfect. There's some challenges which we can talk about, but these were two illustrations of interesting and innovative programs that I think are important for people to know about.
Well, before we get into the specifics of those, let's start with Champaign. Julie, you cover education for the News Gazette. Can you sort of explain how choice works? And with, I think a lot of people hear terms of school choice and wonder if you could explain to our listeners how that works in Champaign specifically.
Well, yes, and this started some years ago through a consent decree, as the Century Foundation's report points out. So each family, when their child is ready to enter kindergarten, gets to make, I think it's up to 5 choices now for where they'd like to send their child, which elementary school, and there are 11 in the district as a whole. And the system tries to balance those choices throughout the district by socioeconomic status. They started out using race as a factor, but after a Supreme Court decision that sort of said that wasn't a good idea, they switched to socioeconomic status. And As the report says, 90% of the families get their first choice, or get one of their choices, not their first choice. And then that child stays at that school, and they have sibling preference for any, you know, brothers or sisters that come along later. And schools are then assigned to a particular middle school so that balance theoretically would, go all the way through 8th grade. And then the high schools are set up differently. They're based on residential, you know, where you live, as far as which school you're assigned to. But some schools are overchosen, some are underchosen, but they're supposed to fall within 15% of the district average in terms of socioeconomic status.
Well, Julie, what I was wondering was, what's the history of how Champaign got to this point of this system? Because I know in the 1940s, the schools were not integrated. We're thinking about, you know, as per typical all-Black and all-white schools. How did we get to where we are now?
Well, as you said, before Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, the schools were fairly segregated. The North End schools tended to be all Black, although some of those had been white in earlier years, you know, when there were other immigrants from other parts of the world. But after, I think only 5 of the 17 elementary schools in Champaign in the 1940s were integrated at that time. And then after the decision, they gradually did desegregate, but it was mostly by they created a magnet school called Booker T. Washington, which is still there, and made it an arts magnet school and trying to entice white families to come to that school, which was in North Champaign. And then Black students were essentially bused around the district. That's how the schools were desegregated. So the white students were bused by choice, as they say. The Black students were bused by forced busing. And then in the 1990s, a group of community parents, mostly African American, you know, sort of were tired of the system and ended up filing a lawsuit against the school district, or a complaint saying that it was unfair to Black students to be forcibly bused. And the district, after, you know, much consideration, decided to adopt this controlled choice plan, which was modeled after one in Massachusetts, I believe. And that's kind of where we ended up, where we are now.
And how does Champaign compare to, you mentioned Urbana, how does Champaign compare to other, the district? Do you have a sense of how it compares to other places in central Illinois in terms of diversity?
I think most of the cities downstate, Springfield, Bloomington, Urbana, would have similar diversity in terms of the district as a whole, in terms of low-income student percentage. I know Urbana's is higher than Champaign's. I don't know what the specific percentages are in Springfield and Bloomington, but I think the, you know, makeup is similar. And I, you know, I think the difference is, you know, Urbana desegregated by basically busing Black students as well around the district, and then taking the children of graduate students who lived in Orchard Downs and bringing them up to Martin Luther King School, which then developed, sort of made, you know, took that situation and ran with it and made itself into this wonderful international program with students from all over the world. But, you know, the you know, Urbana white families, you know, who were permanent residents really didn't have to be bused against their will, as they said. So both districts sort of tried to find a creative way not to disrupt white students initially when this all came down. But, you know, that district is more, I think, naturally integrated these days, although, you know, I think they changed things at King, and they made Leal Elementary School, Leal Elementary School became kind of a dual language program for a lot of Hispanic students, and that's become a very successful program. So they've tried creative ways to do this.
Yeah, it's interesting. The language, it turns out to be a big draw for middle class, probably, parents as well, right? And that's a way to kind of bring in.
That was the idea, yes, right.
And has that worked, would you say?
I think it has. I don't know as much about that, but I mean, from all, everything I hear, it seems to work well. You know, most parents these days would like their children to have a second language, you know, starting early. One of the complaints I have about schools is that children don't get language instruction until middle school, you know, way past the time when they learn it easily.
Right, so, when they absorbed, right. So having right, these elementary programs, right.
Right, their brains are more flexible. And actually, Champaign is starting a similar thing with their international academy. They've started at a school in central Champaign. It's dual language instruction from day one in every class. So students learn in Spanish and English every day, both students with a Spanish background and students with an English background. So, there, you know, there are innovative programs going on to try to further this in ways that appeal to parents of all backgrounds, you know, as he was saying before. I think that's a key with all of this is that, you know, you don't want to alienate one group of parents by trying to help another group, because what ends up happening is then people leave. You know, people go to private school, people go to Catholic school, and the problem just sort of perpetuates itself. So I think, as he said, the key is to make middle-class and upper-class parents think, this can benefit me too.
And do you have a sense that you think that has worked in the Champaign area?
I think it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I feel like the school district provides excellent education. There's so many talented kids in the school system. We've gotten an excellent education for our two kids, I will say, in public schools. But as I said before, you know, the private school population is growing. There's a brand new academy that's being created in the U of I Research Park, very expensive, although they said they'll have scholarships. And, you know, trying to appeal to academic parents, I think, that place a high priority on education. But again, you know, you're drawing kids who might otherwise go to public school, maybe to another private school, but, you know, I think that's a bit worrisome for the future of public schools. I think we have to think about that as a society. I have nothing against them, but, you know, they are not as socioeconomically diverse as public schools are.
Yeah, Richard, as Julie's just talking about socioeconomic status, free and reduced lunch has traditionally been a way that we kind of distinguish that often in a school setting. Is there sort of an ideal ratio or proportion of variety of students in terms of socioeconomic status? Like, are there percentages, or how would that work, Richard?
Well, the best evidence we have suggests that students will do well in schools that are between 30 and 70% low income. That is 30 and 70% eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And that has to do with the two reasons that we want integration. So on the one hand, we want to avoid concentrations of poverty because we know that that tends to depress student achievement. And so that's why it's important to get below 70% low income. At the same time, there are positive benefits to diversity that are more apparent when students don't feel completely isolated. So that's why it's better to have that minimum of 30% low income, so that you don't have a situation where a school lacks a critical mass of low-income or minority students, and therefore the students don't feel comfortable participating in class. So one of those benefits of diversity is that students will be exposed to different sets of life experiences, and we want students to really participate in classroom discussion, and when they feel isolated, they're less likely to participate.
When we think about that, Julie, what does it look like in terms of Champaign schools? Are Champaign schools across the district meeting that threshold of around 30%, or are there schools that are a little bit different?
There are some lower and some higher. I was just looking at the district-wide average. It's closer to 60% in terms of low income.
60.
Mm-hmm. 60, yes.
Okay.
And which Urbana is even higher, our sister city here. The school my kids attended, Southside, is a smaller school, and it traditionally fell below that threshold, and some schools were higher. So what you see in Champaign is more and more private schools and sort of quote-unquote suburban school districts drawing families away that are in higher income brackets. So the public schools are left with a greater share of kids, you know, from low-income families. So we've seen that going up over the years. So, you know, this is a struggle for the school districts because, of course, you know, that brings with it other issues. And part of the choice system is to try to, you know, as he said, spread that out and make sure one school doesn't have too high a percentage. But, you know, it does vary.
Mm-hmm. So, Richard, what Julie's talking about in terms of diversity of schools, you were talking about sort of that 30% being ideal. Julie's giving us an example of the Champaign-Urbana being close to about 60%. What does that look like nationally? What are we at nationally when we look at public schools in terms of, do we have kind of nationally the way the system is right now? Is it pockets of high concentration, like high poverty schools versus other schools?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of economic segregation in residential areas, and that's reflected in our public school system. So we've seen a growth in the proportion of students going to high poverty schools, you know, those that are really above 70-75% low income, and that's had negative effects on academic achievement. So you know, nationally, we're seeing the kind of the resegregation of schools by race and also increasing segregation by income, which is really of great concern educationally. It's encouraging that there are now 100 school districts, including places like Champaign and Chicago, which are trying to do something to address those inequalities and make sure that everyone can get a good education in a solid, diverse setting.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about how K-12 schools and the difference it makes with those schools to have a good mix of high-income and low-income students, and middle-income students in there, too. This has been found to be a really effective way to eliminate school inequalities and improve outcomes for all of the students. My guests are Richard Collenberg, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, and Julie Worth, a reporter at the News Gazette in Champaign. Richard, just before the break, we were talking about how Champaign has established a school system that promotes socioeconomic diversity. And I wanted to ask you, what did you find in Chicago? What are the ways Chicago's doing this when we think about Chicago being a city with such wide disparity? You know, lots of people talk about how there are two Chicagos. There's the wealthy Chicago and then the very poor parts of Chicago. And not very much middle class. So how is Chicago trying to handle this?
Right. Well, Chicago has large numbers of low-income students in the public school system. And so simply doing what Champaign is seeking, where all the schools would be roughly comparable, would really end up meaning that all the schools would be high poverty, which is not ideal. And so instead, Chicago seeks to socioeconomically integrate a subset of schools. So these are the magnet schools that people choose into, and what they call the selective enrollment schools. These are the schools that students test into, and students who are doing well academically. The problem is that if those selective enrollment schools were based simply on academic achievement as traditionally understood, you could end up with those schools being overwhelmingly wealthy and white and Asian. And that's not good for our society. And so Chicago is trying to honor merit by looking at academic achievement of students in the context of what obstacles those students have had to overcome. So if a low-income student who is from a single-parent family and faces lots of disadvantages manages to do pretty well considering what hurdles they had to overcome, then they ought to be given a shot to go to these selective schools.
And Chicago's always still tough with that, right? Because there's such a proportion of families that can afford to deliberately send their kids to private schools for pre-high school to have them prepare so they can test in well into a selective enrollment school as well. So that's another thing that kind of complicates things with Chicago.
Well, that's right. And so if Chicago relied simply on the academic criteria, they'd give, in essence, an unfair advantage to all the wealthier students who've been able to purchase a superior education. And so instead, what Chicago does is they say, okay, you know, we believe in merit, we believe in academic criteria, but at the same time, we want to make sure that there are some fairness guidelines in place to ensure that we're tapping into the talents of more disadvantaged students. And so Chicago divides the census tracts into four different socioeconomic tiers, from the most advantaged to the least advantaged, and then allocates seats so that the most academically able students from each of those categories has an opportunity to attend the selective schools. And as a result, the Chicago public selective schools are far more racially and ethnically diverse than in some jurisdictions like New York City, where you have tiny numbers of African American and Latino students at the selective schools, because they aren't considering that question of fairness and whether students have overcome obstacles.
Well, when we think about this, I wonder, Julie, I have a question for you about Champaign. If there's a sense, as you cover this issue on a local level, I imagine you hear from both students and from parents and families. What's the sense of how this has been working in Champaign? Is this a popular thing for the community?
As far as the choice system?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, kind of goes up and down. It was controversial when it was put in place, but it was also seen by its proponents as a creative way to deal with, you know, the racial disparities in the schools. And as it's evolved, you know, into an economic factor, I think it's sort of less visible, you know, and maybe we're just used to it by now. And I don't have little kids anymore, so I don't hear parents complaining as much. And it's worked out, you know, fairly well. But I think the thing the school district is grappling with now, as the report points out, is not just, you know, sort of balancing the schools on a numbers basis, but access to those, you know, challenging gifted programs and honors classes, you know, similar to what he was talking about with Chicago's magnet schools, you know, how to get more diversity in those programs as well. And I think that's what the district, you know, is sort of struggling with now. They've tried some programs to encourage that, but they still got some work to do there.
Right, right. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about public schools and integration and what it means when a school is socioeconomically diverse. My guests are Richard Collenberg. He's with the bipartisan think tank, the Century Foundation. He's a senior fellow. We're talking about a paper they recently released that used 9 case studies to look at why social and economic diversity is so important, particularly for lower income students. They used 2 Illinois school districts, Chicago and Champaign. That's why my next guest is with us as well, Julie Worth covers education for the News Gazette in Champaign. As we think about this going forward, Julie, I wonder if you could just answer, just before the break, we were talking about when this was implemented and how popular it was, and you were also just talking about the challenges of those higher level advanced placement classes, gifted classes, honors classes. Richard, what are ways that schools can do better at integrating students in? I think so much of the model of what we're talking about is test-based, and as you said, part of that is inherently flawed. What are best practices you've learned from other school districts about how they're learning to integrate students more into these higher-level classes?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case studies that my colleague Hallie Potter worked on, she compared Champaign, which is has struggled a little bit with some of the tracking issues, where low-income students and minority students end up in the lower tracks by and large, and you know, white and wealthier students end up at the higher tracks. And by contrast, she also found that Stamford, Connecticut, which has an integration program, had done some innovative things to try to make sure that all students have access to strong curriculum and strong teachers. And probably the most important method they use is something called embedded honors programs, where rather than having an honors track and then the regular track for students that often can be segregated, they have one track that's an honors track, and then within that, students who are more academically inclined are given you know, more complicated assignments that are that go deeper. They're, you know, they continue to be challenged, but within the same classroom rather than in a completely separate classroom from others.
Mm-hmm. So apart from that, as we're thinking about sort of the headlines of this, about the role that socioeconomic diversity plays, I wonder what you see as, Richard, the biggest challenges to implementing what you've saw in these 9 case studies. We talked about choice, for example, in Champaign, what Chicago's doing with its magnet schools and its selective enrollment. What are the biggest challenges to implementing this across the country?
Well, I think there is a social science consensus that poverty concentrations are bad for education, but there's this unfortunate political consensus, I think an outdated political consensus, that, well, there's not that much you can do about it. And for much of the Obama administration, in fact, that was true, where the major effort that the president put forward in education was investing $7 billion into struggling schools to try to make them work better. It was kind of the old separate, trying to make separate but equal work. Towards the end of the administration, the Secretary of Education, John King, started pushing diversity, and so I think was beginning to show that politically it is possible to promote integration. The key is, though, to make sure that middle-class parents recognize that diversity is going to be good for their kids as well. And that can be done in part by providing special magnet programs that will appeal to certain parents whose kids would thrive in an arts program or a science program, and also to educate people about the ways in which all students benefit from socioeconomic and racial diversity.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about the Obama administration. The obvious question now, then, is with the incoming Trump administration, with what we've seen of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's advocacy for charter schools and for voucher programs, what's your sense of where the Trump administration will take all of this?
Well, there was an early and very discouraging signal recently when Secretary DeVos canceled an innovative program designed to promote socioeconomic diversity. It's clearly not a priority for the Trump administration. And that's where, you know, I thank God that we have a system of federalism in this country, that most education decisions are made at the state and local level. And I think we're likely to see more interest in school diversity efforts because people across the political spectrum recognize we just went through one of the most divisive elections in memory, and we need public schools to remind people what they have in common as Americans. You know, our democracy is really under threat, and we don't want a system where a politician can scapegoat minorities, given that, you know, students don't have that much experience with those of different backgrounds. Integrated schools, by contrast, make it much harder for a demagogue to come in and single out minorities and blame them for society's ills. So I think even though we're not likely to get much federal support for school integration, we may see greater dedication to school integration at the state and local level.
Richard Kahlenberg is senior fellow with the bipartisan think tank in Washington, the Century Foundation. We'll be tweeting out more of those links so you can read that case study. Richard, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Julie Wirth, a reporter at the News Gazette. Julie, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Nyla.
On tomorrow's program, we're going to be speaking with Chicago cellist Tamika Reed. She's based there. She's going to be performing in Chicago tomorrow. And we wanted to give you a preview. Before we talk to her, let's take a listen to one of her songs. It's 17 West off of her debut album as the band leader of the Tamika Reed Quartet. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have the NPR One app and Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all of that is at our website, 21stshow.org. You follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background context about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with engineering help from Steve Mork as well. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.